Hello everyone, I'm Chetan Bhatt and I'm Director of the Centre for the Study of Human Rights at the LSE, and I'd like to, on this cold evening, warmly welcome you to this event hosted by the Centre, and I'd like to thank you for joining us this evening. And this event is chosen to mark International Human Rights Day, which is on the 8th of December, which is next week. And International Human Rights Day in 1948 was the date when the United Nations General Assembly adopted the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, the first genuinely global declaration. Now, this evening's talk is on the populist challenge to human rights and will be given by our distinguished speaker, Professor Philip Alston, who I can tell you has literally just come off a plane to be with us this evening, so I'm immensely grateful. Now, obviously, people are going to be thinking about the US presidential election, and everyone's talking about Donald Trump. We're taking the lead that he has given us. And his status as president-elect of the world's most powerful country has, to put it very mildly, alarmed the US and international human rights community, and indeed, so many people are saying, all decent folk everywhere. But he's only the latest example of an international phenomena which is regularly called populism or authoritarian populism or right-wing populism. And internationally, there's been a very clear pattern of the emergence of authoritarian figures in recent years in several formal democracies or semi-democracies. Aside from Trump, we can refer to Putin, Erdogan, Narendra Modi in India, Netanyahu, Farage, Le Pen, Orban, among many other figures. And these developments reflect a wider accommodation in democracies to new political styles that seem to be based on nativism, on illiberalism, xenophobia, misogyny, and an aversion to democratic accountability and the undermining of several independent democratic institutions, as well as elements of the rule of law. One consequence of the rise of popular authoritarian figures has been what's been called a systematic attack by several governments on domestic and international NGOs and their international donors, as illustrated by the introduction of punitive legislation in several countries, including Russia, Turkey, India, China, among others. To help us make sense of these developments, I'm honored to introduce to you Professor Philip Alston, who is John Norton Pomeroy Professor of Law and Co-Chair of New York University's Center for Human Rights and Global Justice. He received degrees from law and in economics in Australia and a doctorate from Berkeley. He has held numerous academic positions, including at the Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy and at Harvard Law School. He was professor of law and foundation director at the Center for International Public Law at the Australian National University. He was professor of international law at the European University Institute in Florence, where he was also head of department and co-director of the Academy of European Law. He was co-founder of both the European Society of International Law and the Australian and New Zealand Societies of International Law. And he's worked as a consultant to the ILO, the UNDP, the Office of the UN High Commissioner on Human Rights, UNESCO, OECD, UNICEF, you get the picture, many other intergovernmental and non-governmental organizations. And other posts he's held include Chief of Staff to a Cabinet Minister in Australia in the Whitlam government in the mid-1970s. And in the human rights area, he's worked in numerous human rights issues since the 1970s. He was appointed in 2014 as a UN Human Rights Council Special Rapporteur on Extreme Poverty and Human Rights. He was previously UN Special Rapporteur on Extrajudicial Summary or Arbitrary Executions, and he undertook fact-finding missions to numerous countries. He was a member of the group of experts on Darfur, appointed in 2007 by the United Nations Human Rights Council, and was special advisor to the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights on the Millennium Development Goals. And I could go on and on and on, and it would take up all the time of this lecture were I to do that. But one important thing for us and for the MSc Human Rights students who are at the LSE is that his work is compulsory reading on so many of our courses. Professor Alston will talk for about 40 minutes, and I hope he's had time to recover from his journey from Heathrow. And there'll be plenty of time for your questions after his presentation. And we need to finish this event by 8 p.m., and you're very welcome to a reception that will be held straight afterwards. Now, this event is being audio recorded, And we should have a podcast of the lecture and the question and answer session in a few days' time. And we encourage you very much to comment live on the event using Twitter, and the suggested hashtag for the event is LSE Human Rights Day. But if you're doing that, can I please ask you and ask everyone to turn off their phones and other electronic devices, or at least turn them to silent? May I ask you to extend your welcome to Professor Philip Alston?
Well, many thanks for that warm welcome. It's a great privilege to be here at LSE. I have never given a talk here, but have visited various friends and colleagues over the years. Let me just disappear for a moment. I'm going to talk tonight not to persuade you that we've all misunderstood Donald Trump and we should give him a second chance. I'm going to talk in rather negative terms, however, which I don't feel particularly comfortable doing, but I think is appropriate at this juncture. As Chetan said, the populist agenda is indeed usually, not quite always, nationalistic, xenophobic, misogynistic, and pretty much always explicitly antagonistic to the international human rights agenda. My sense, therefore, is that the challenges that we're going to face in the human rights community are actually very different from those that have gone before. I think this really is a watershed. This doesn't mean, as various scholars have told us, that these are the end times of human rights or that we've entered the post-human rights era. I think those phrases are excellent for selling books, but I don't think they're very helpful for much else. I don't think we should despair, and I don't think, as Samuel Moyne says, that there's a desperate need to find tools other than human rights with which to combat the many challenges that the new populism, combined with the old authoritarianism, will definitely bring. But I think it does mean that that human rights proponents generally need to rethink many of their assumptions, reevaluate their strategies, and broaden their outreach while not giving up on their basic principles. As each new wave of bad news sweeps in, most of us are now suffering from commentary and analysis fatigue. I certainly am, and I read about 1/20th of what my wife reads and sends on to me. I haven't yet read about what Trump, Erdogan, and Duterte mean for the future of bananas, but I'm sure someone's working on that as well. I want to instead focus on what the human rights community should be doing in terms of creative strategizing for the era ahead. One of the justifications that's given, certainly in the US, for not having done much of that so far is that it's too soon to tell. Sadly, I don't believe that's true for a moment. I think we know pretty much what's happening. We might know who Trump is going to appoint to one or two posts, or how exactly the political chemistry will work out between Trump and some of the other leaders of the New World Disorder. But we do know the basic terms of the challenges that we're going to confront. We know from Trump himself that he's consistently advocated measures that would abrogate civil liberties for American citizens, not to mention non-citizens, a great many of whom are already traumatized. It is quite striking in New York City, which is an immigrant city, and it's even striking, strangely, in my own law school, the number of students and even some of my colleagues who really are traumatized by what's going on. But the good news is that Trump's wrath won't only be directed at minorities. Two days ago, he tweeted, "Nobody should be allowed to burn the American flag. If they do, there must be consequences. Perhaps loss of citizenship or a year in jail. Thanks, Donald. He's, I don't think, a First Amendment specialist in the US, but that sort of doesn't matter if this is the attitude that you have and if you are controlling the Justice Department and various other government authorities. Every appointment that he's made so far is from the far right of the spectrum, often combined with a total lack of expertise in the relevant portfolio, and his nominees all stand for radical changes to existing policies. On the UN, his principal earlier comment was that we get nothing out of the United Nations. They don't respect us. They don't do what we want. Shame. We'll change that, sir. And yet we fund them disproportionately. Recall that the principal contributor to the budget of the Office of the High Commissioner for Human Rights is the United States. Some 12 to 13% of the voluntary funds that it depends very heavily on, 60% of its budget is voluntary, and the US pays 12% of that total. Interestingly, most of that money goes to the voluntary trust fund for the victims of torture. I think US efforts will instead be directed elsewhere in relation to victims of torture rather than the trust fund in the years ahead. Assuming that Trump's policies on human rights are what we pretty much know they will be, the only other thing we need to know is that, and Chetan said this, is that an increasingly diverse array of governments have all expressed a desire to push back against key pillars of the international human rights regime. While it's certainly true that the nature and extent of the challenges differ greatly from one country to the next or one leader to the next, it also seems they've got much in common. And for the purpose of considering the implications for the international regime, I foresee with great confidence, I have to say, the emergence of a powerful and energetic coalition of the willing, to reprise an infamous phrase from the not-so-distant past. The coalition will consist of governments of many different stripes, but which are keen to challenge and dilute existing human rights standards, and especially to undermine existing institutional arrangements which threaten to constrain them in any way. There have always been coalitions of would-be wreckers. I've dealt with a lot of them over the years. But in the past, they've met with at least some pushback, whether from the United States, whether from other Western governments, or from Latin American governments. The prospect of effective pushback in the future, I think, is now evaporating before our eyes. We will soon know what sorts of coalitions from hell will emerge in the context of the UN Human Rights Council, the International Criminal Court, the Inter-American Human Rights System, and so on. Unpredictability is certain, and few targets will be off limits. In contrast to the past, the coalitions will be more diverse, less focused on particular issues, more willing to depart from established understandings and conventions, and less constrained by appeals to behave responsibly or in line with their legal obligations. Before reflecting on how best the international human rights community can respond to these challenges, it's useful to keep some general principles in mind. First, we do need to maintain perspective, despite the multitude of challenges. Defending human rights has never been a consensus project. It's always been the product of struggle. The modern human rights regime emerged out of the ashes of the deepest authoritarian dysfunction and the greatest conflagration the world had ever known. The human rights regime has duelled with and been shaped by, for better and worse, the eras of reluctant decolonisation, the Cold War, neoliberalism, and now populism. Dejection and despair are pointless and self-defeating. It's assuredly not a lost cause, but we shouldn't be fooled into thinking that it's ever going to be a winning cause. It's an ongoing struggle. That's what human rights are all about. Second, this is the start of a long-term effort. It won't be over in 4 years. I suspect that Trump will be over in less than 4 years, but I won't go down that road. I don't need to read out the honour roll of triumphant populists, nor the list of those waiting in the wings. But there are many, and no continent is immune, unless we count Antarctica. but I think there are a lot of angry and alienated penguins down there as well. The main characteristic of the populist authoritarian era is disdain for a range of social conventions, a currency on which human rights has long been heavily dependent. We tend to assume, especially the international lawyers, that they are legal conventions in the formal sense that are important, but it's social conventions which we're seeing destroyed very quickly by Trump and his ilk. The assumptions that keep our societies together, that keep us from doing all sorts of things that are contrary to human rights. And the devaluation of that currency opens up immense horizons for the enemies of human rights. Third, I think the human rights movement needs to develop a spirit of introspection and openness. Historically, it hasn't responded well to criticism. As long as that criticism was only coming from governments which were seeking to defend themselves, or from despairing deconstructionist scholars, it wasn't difficult to continue with business as usual. Going forward, it'll be highly desirable for such efforts to reflect on the weaknesses of the past and the opportunities in the future. What are some of the key issues? Obviously, there are vastly too many for me to consider, and I want to just mention four before looking at some of the things that I think the human rights movement needs to start doing. The first is the threat to democracy, which is fundamental and underpins much of what else is going on. In the post-9/11 era, security concerns have been exploited to justify huge trade-offs, not just by governments, but in the public mind. Many of us, we have to acknowledge, have been convinced that there are trade-offs, that we should make them because that's the only way to be secure. The new era of internal threats, which have been exploding in recent years, is bringing with it a move to normalise states of emergency. No one really bats an eyelid as the French continue to expand a pretty draconian state of emergency. It's not for a moment to say that the threats that they have identified and the horrors they've been through are to be underestimated, but the extent of the state of emergency is stunning, and it's not really an issue for most people. There is a declining faith generally in democracy. An article soon to be published identifies three tests which should be applied in order to look at the robustness of democracy. First, the extent of public support. In other words, how important it is for people that the country remain democratic. Secondly, the openness of the public to a non-democratic government. In other words, would you countenance military rule if needs be, if things went really wrong? Would you countenance that in the UK? Would we countenance that in Australia? And third, the growth of anti-system parties and movements. And based on those criteria, these authors, Monk and Roa, argue that there is a radical diminution in the support for democracy in many of the established democracies. In other words, there is a growing openness to considering alternatives which might offer a happier future. The next threat to democracy, of course, is the role of civil society. There's a phrase that's now always used by human rights proponents, which is that that space is shrinking. They are misleading you. That space has closed in a great many countries. Civil society is being closed down, and pretty effectively. I was in Mauritania in May as a UN special rapporteur. You can set up an NGO in Mauritania. All you need is prior authorization from the Ministry of Interior. which takes a very, very long time to get for most NGOs. If you are a human rights group, you are going to have to operate as an unauthorised group, which means that you can be arrested and imprisoned at any moment. The one sector that is thriving is that of government NGOs. I had meetings in Geneva with groups of NGOs, who came to meet me in Geneva. They seemed to be quite well off. They were able to fly over from Mauritania and spend a few days hanging around the Human Rights Council just to talk to me. And they assured me that I had utterly misunderstood all that was going on in the country, and that in fact the government was totally dedicated to promoting respect for human rights and the best chance that we have. This was the NGO sector. A month or so after my visit, and after I'd met with some of the activists concerned, 13 of the leading activists of the most controversial NGO, the one fighting against the remnants of slavery, were arrested on charges that are said, and I consider this to be accurate, to have been trumped up. Charges of participating in a demonstration which they claim they were not present at, which turned violent, and they were sentenced for their troubles to terms of between 3 and 15 years in prison. So much for civil society. I was in China in August. Arranging a visit to China was interesting, if I can put it that way. I got the names of a great many scholars, people who were active in human rights, and so on. I either phoned them or sent them messages. And almost every one of them, I guess they're a very loyal people, they were all going out to the countryside to spend time with their mother during the time that I was there. All of them. In other words, the message had been sent loud and clear by the authorities that none of these people were to speak to a UN special rapporteur. Those who tried, some of them were arrested. Some of them were subsequently harassed very significantly after my visit, immediately after meeting with me. The government has adopted a law on foreign NGOs. The government has adopted a charity law, and between them, these new laws and regulations have succeeded basically in closing all space for any groups that consider themselves to be working on human rights. Egypt, yesterday, you may have seen, passed a law limiting NGO activity to social and development work and banning all NGOs from cooperating in any way with any international body without governmental approval. Basically, the end of NGO official activity in Egypt. So much for the prescription of those authors who say that we need to abandon the international human rights regime and move all of our efforts back to the national and local level. Good luck. I hope some of those authors go and live in some of these countries and many others that I could name. They won't be getting very far. Second set of issues that I'd like to mention are inequality and exclusion. Populism is driven in part by fear and resentment. Mainstream human rights advocacy addresses at best in a tokenistic manner the issues of economic and social rights and almost not at all the issue of inequality. I'll come back to this. Similarly, the focus of almost all human rights advocacy is on marginal and oppressed individuals and minority groups. From our traditional perspective, that's how it should be. They're the ones who need the help. People like me don't need help. Elderly, white males Fine, thank you. We're doing well. But the reality is that if the majority in society feel that they have no stake in the human rights enterprise, and that human rights groups really are just working for asylum seekers, felons, terrorists, and others, and I put those in inverted commas, obviously, they're far less likely to be supportive out of some disappearing ethos of solidarity. I believe that a renewed focus on social rights and on diminishing inequality is part of a new human rights agenda which offers a lot to a lot of people who are feeling marginalised and badly done by as a result of what we loosely call globalisation, economic change. Next issue, the international rule of law is very much a threat, under threat. I have fewer suggestions as to what we might do, I have to say. Just to focus on two issues under the heading of the international rule of law. The first is the breaking down of rules governing the use of force. Western countries, more specifically the United States, through the global operations of the CIA, and the JSOC, the Joint Strategic Operations Command, and its ever supportive, never questioning allies, such as the United Kingdom and Australia, have set us up very nicely for the era of Syria, Crimea, and Yemen, in which you can write your own rules. We're not very well placed when we've stood by and let those different agencies operate all around the world, doing targeted killings and a lot of other things, to then turn around and say that some of the tactics used by countries we don't like are in violation of international rules. The assiduous efforts of legal advisers, current and former, in both the US and the UK, to rationalise these incursions are now reaping the rewards that they so richly deserved. And I think that's a tragedy. It was predicted at the time, particularly when I was involved in the whole debate over targeted killings with the United States, but there was no interest in the problem, the fact that precedents were being set which would inevitably be invoked by much less well-meaning forces in the future. And that's now coming back to haunt us. There's a breakdown in relation to international humanitarian law, which is dramatic. And I don't know what we're doing about it or what we can do about it. Systematic targeted attacks on medical facilities, on operations by Médecins Sans Frontières and other humanitarian groups, are commonplace and barely remarked upon. The United States did apologise for one very direct and clearly targeted attack, but not credibly so, in my view. And at the same time, we've got the Prime Minister of the United Kingdom promising to liberate British forces from the European Convention on Human Rights, and Donald Trump making similar noises about how our boys cannot be constrained in ways that others are not. International humanitarian law is in a very bad way. Fourth and finally, in terms of issues, we've got the fragility of international institutions. The International Criminal Court's been much in the headlines. Various African states which have announced their withdrawal. I'm sure that the announcement by the Office of the Prosecutor that she is actively investigating CIA and other forces' activities in Afghanistan and related countries will also greatly endear the court to the United States. And I suspect that we're in for an extremely tough ride in terms of trying to withstand and protect what's been achieved by that court. The Office of the High Commissioner for Human Rights, one of the bright spots in the overall view is that the High Commissioner, Zayed Al-Hussein, has been speaking out very forcefully and still has another couple of years left in his mandate. He's doing what a High Commissioner should do. He's acting as the moral conscience, and he can't be removed, at least in normal circumstances, for at least until, I think, September of 2018. The Human Rights Council has been operating in a way that is surprisingly balanced in the last few years. When I was Special Rapporteur on Executions, a period which finished in 2010, I left in despair, not so much at the activities of the United States, but at the organization of the Islamic Conference, which was able to control and manipulate much that the Council did, and generally not for the good. That changed with the Arab Spring, and it hasn't returned. So the Council has been able to operate in a way that is surprisingly constructive in certain areas. China and Russia have both made it very clear that they plan to introduce or to reintroduce major, quote, reforms of the Council. And there's nothing scarier than a reform when presented by either of those two great supporters. The European Court of Human Rights, we know that there is a waning affection in this country. We also know that Russia and Turkey are virtually unresponsive members these days. Let us hope that that won't be at risk, but nothing can be certain. The Inter-American Commission on Human Rights, an announcement in the summer that it was going to lose 40% of its staff, was headed off at the very last moment by some new contributions, but that's highly unlikely to last. And again, the United States plays an outsized role in that area. And finally, in institutional terms, the slashing of development assistance budgets, which is an ongoing process which will certainly be accelerated. If you are nationalistic and xenophobic, you're not going to be sending a lot of money to anyone other than your authoritarian cronies. Much of development assistance has gone to support human rights institutions in different places, and that will all soon be under threat. So let me try to be a little bit more constructive. I want to end by talking about the strategies that I think the human rights community needs to start considering. First, I think we do need more effective synergies between international and local movements. I don't think that most of the large NGOs have got this right. I don't think that Human Rights Watch, for all its efforts to establish offices in country and so on, is working as well as it might to strengthen, to build up local human rights capacity. I don't think most other international NGOs, despite their very good faith, are doing that either. And there will come a time when we need much more to rely alternately, if not international, local, if not local, internationally, and both sides need to be strengthened. I don't think nearly enough is being done. I've talked about the economic and social rights agenda. I could go on about that for a very long time, but I will try not to. Just to say that I submitted a report to the Human Rights Council in June of this year, which argued, I think, in terms that are very difficult to rebut, but I would think that, that very few NGOs that consider themselves to be working on human rights actually do anything much on economic and social rights. The question is that a problem? Well, many people have argued traditionally, no, it's the American line, because if you have political freedoms, which we are fighting for, you'll be able to fight for your own social rights. I'm afraid it's nonsense. It hasn't worked. It hasn't brought social rights. It hasn't brought them to the United States. And it hasn't brought them on its own to most other countries. We need to start understanding human rights as embracing equally both of the categories of rights. We need to work out not ways in which every organisation can suddenly become an economic and social rights organisation, but ways in which they can constructively contribute to that side of the agenda. And that hasn't happened so far. Amnesty International has tried. I believe, and I think Amnesty knows this, that I think they have failed. I don't think their efforts have been very effective at all. I think they have been reluctant to grasp the real nettle, which is economic and social rights as human rights. Not a broad focus on poverty, not a broad focus on dignity, not more resources for development, but economic and social human rights, which in the report that I presented argues that you need to have recognition of those rights at the domestic level. We don't, if we're worried about torture, the first thing we say to a state is, we don't just want bland assurances that you won't torture. We want legislation in place to ban it. We then say we want institutions that are able to follow up and make sure, to monitor and to take action and to promote. And we then say we want accountability. We want to be able to charge those who have tortured. We want to bring governments to account who tolerate this sort of conduct. Economic and social rights are not different, but they are fundamentally misunderstood by the great majority of governments, and I would say even activists. They are conflated with or confused with development or poverty. I want you to promote economic and social rights. Oh my God, that's going to cost a fortune. We don't have the resources to give everyone health care and so on. I don't want everyone to have health care immediately. That's not the point. You start by building the human rights structure, which is recognising that there's a right to health. Then you build up the institutions which are specialised, which are going to promote that in ways that are meaningful in that society. And then you start building up accountability. There is, of course, an issue that goes side by side with that, and that is the question of resources, which leads many people to say, ah, but you know, social rights, they cost a lot of money, and civil rights, well, they cost very little. Nonsense. All rights cost money, and all we're doing is making choices. We're going to put all the money into one particular set of rights, which suits me, as I said before. I mean, I'm an elderly white male. I've got it all. I've got a big pension fund. I've got great health insurance. My kids' schooling is provided for. I don't care, as long as my civil and political rights are there, as long as I'm protected, not arrested. I've got freedom of speech. That's great. But that's not going to help the great majority of the population. There needs to be a focus on the other side of the balance sheet. And when we come to resources, I said I could speak for too long, I'll stop on this particular point in just a minute. What we're seeing now is that the real battle for human rights in many places is actually over resources. It's actually over fiscal policy. Keep your eye on the Donald. The Donald is going to make huge changes in the United States through the tax code, the code that has served him so nicely over the how many ever years he's never paid taxes. Things like his infrastructure program is basically a boondoggle for private industries, the way it's going to be set up, funded by taxpayers. And the rest of the shrinking government budget will be used to find welfare cheats. who won't be getting much anyway because we're moving to much more privatised education in the US, emphasis on vouchers. We're moving to privatisation potentially of Social Security if Paul Ryan gets his way, as looks increasingly likely. So we need, even as human rights proponents, to start looking, I'm sorry about this, it's not good news, to start looking at budgets, at tax policy, at fiscal policy. The Brazilians know this, and that's why the new government that got rid of Dilma Rousseff has introduced legislation which I think is going to be adopted by their Senate in the next few days. It's excellent legislation. It will cap all public spending, particularly on education, health, welfare, etc., for the next 20 years. There will be no possibility of expanding the current amount of money spent, regardless of population growth, regardless of changes in priorities. That government is moving to lock in an anti-social rights policy, which will not be able to be changed constitutionally because you won't have this particular constellation in the parliamentary setup again. 20 years of no additional expenditures. What are we doing about that? Nothing. Next, I think the human rights community needs to start thinking about what other actors it can work with. I mentioned business, and I have to say that I'm as sceptical as many others about the likelihood that businesses are going to ever start acting as great proponents of human rights. But leave aside the guiding principles and other sort of micro-level stuff. Surely we can start to have a conversation with the larger corporations about whether an authoritarian future, which is being created through a lot of the activities that are going on, is really in their interests, and where they can start to stand up, where they can stop lobbying for the counter-human rights moves to be made. I think we need to start thinking creatively who the other allies are going to be that the human rights movement can draw upon. Next, we need to return to greater persuasion rather than simply enunciating our principles as though they were self-evident. I'll give you it's a petty example, but I recently wrote a report on the responsibility of the United Nations for bringing cholera to Haiti. In that report, I said, I'm going to invoke a lot of practical arguments designed to persuade the UN that it's in its own self-interest to take this move, to accept responsibility, to provide compensation. I don't believe that simply stating to international organisations or to states that they have human rights obligations is actually going to get you very far in most cases. Someone for whom I have the greatest respect, a very strong human rights defender, saw a draft and wrote back saying, Philip, you've got to take that out. That's really not appropriate. Our business is to state principles, and we shouldn't have to persuade people on the basis of other arguments. I think it's nonsense. I think we need to be much more instrumentalist. I think we need to start thinking why the other side is not doing things. I'm not talking about silly issues like torture. You know, why is it that the poor people want to torture? Perhaps we can get inside their psyche and persuade them more. But a great many human rights issues are quite complex. And if we're trying to persuade others, very much in a way that I have sometimes found problematic, but generally it works, where you get an organisation like the World Bank, which will tell you that it doesn't really care about women's rights. Who cares about women's rights? Ah, but hang on. women are productive assets. And because women are productive assets, we should be investing in them and their capabilities. Not my preferred way to go, by any means, but it's not a bad secondary argument to use to governments. And I think there are many cases in which human rights proponents don't take enough time to outline all of the other arguments that might be more persuasive at the end of the day. I think we need to take a step back from some of the absolutism that sometimes manifests itself, uncompromising, the fear that if we make any concessions along the way, we are selling out on the basics of human rights. I know there are a number of close friends of Pepe Zaliquet here tonight. Pepe's most significant former head of Amnesty's International Executive Committee, I guess, and a very distinguished human rights defender, member of the Chilean Human Rights Commission, wrote a very influential article, not apologising for a moment for the choice that his commission made in giving priority to truth over justice. Basically saying, look, it's irresponsible to hold out for everything if you're not going to get it and you're going to jeopardise what can be got. So my commission, he said, went for truth. And we had the confidence that over time, by putting the truth on the record, the other side of the agenda could ultimately be addressed. And so it's come to pass. I think we need to learn from that in the human rights community. I'll give a controversial example, which I've never said before, and I may well be attacked. That's good. Happy to get into a fight. The threat to the International Criminal Court, I think, as I've said before, is pretty grave. I think there is a very big and strong movement. I think it's led by Africans. And the key issue there, at least the key issue that's been put on the table, and I think it genuinely is a, if not the key issue, is the immunity of heads of state. That's what most of these countries allege they are going to leave the ICC for, that it is unacceptable that a sitting head of state can be charged and required to go to The Hague. Now, this is one of the great achievements of the Rome Statute, that no one is immune. Everyone is subject to the jurisdiction, even a sitting head of state. And who more deserving than a president who's in office and who's undertaking such criminal acts? But let's step back for a moment. The enterprise of the International Criminal Court is extraordinarily important in historical and other terms. Sitting heads of state are not able to be prosecuted in a great many countries. We know the situation in France. Not possible. You've got to wait until the president of France has stepped down. There are many other such cases. Should the coalition of supporters of the ICC not contemplate making that concession? This is not to change the statute. This is to say that we would be open to deferrals by the Security Council on a year-by-year basis if a sitting head of state is impugned in an investigation. What I'm arguing is that in an era where human rights is, I think, dramatically under threat, and I've never spoken in these terms before, I think we need to start thinking more creatively. We need to start thinking what it is that might take some of the wind out of the sails. And I don't believe that, as Pepe Zaliquet would have said, I don't believe this means a surrender. I don't believe we cannot give up fundamental principles, but there are strategies for getting there and achieving them, and it might not be all or nothing. Finally, I'm saying that to try to make Chetan feel better.
Fine.
I think what we need to do as people interested in human rights is to think what our own role is. I really think this is central. I think all of us can do things for human rights. In my travels around the world, one of the most, I suppose, entertaining little plays that has come out almost consistently in countries that I've been to, at about halfway through my presence in a country, someone will say in a government meeting, "Who invited this bastard?" And the answer is sort of fascinating, because it's never the Minister of Foreign Affairs, it's never the presidency or whatever, and usually you sort of look around the room and finally, it's her, the Minister for Health. What the hell? She's got no authority in the government. How did that happen? And she just casually thought, well, it might be helpful if we get a UN Special Rapporteur to visit. That happened to me in the Philippines, I remember vividly, although they knew exactly how I'd been invited, but nonetheless, who actually surrendered and issued the invitation. And I think the simple point I'm trying to make is that all of us are in a position to make a difference if we want to, not to be despondent, but to work out what we can do. It can also be very minor and mercenary. I do believe that we should be contributing now in ways that most of us probably haven't been, to human rights groups, to those that are going to stand up and defend rights. It's no coincidence that the ACLU got, I think, $9 million in the weeks after the election, and they'll be getting more from me. It's absolutely essential for us to strengthen, when we can, the frontline organisations that are going to be trying to stand up to the new populism. Finally, I turn to scholars, and again, this is a controversial statement. I want to say that as teachers, as authors, we actually have obligations to our students and our readers. It's highly fashionable to trash human rights, to accentuate in dramatic and destructive ways the undoubted shortcomings of international human rights. I never cease to be amazed at the number of law schools that I visit where students are essentially disillusioned because they've been taught that this is all an illusion, that it's not something that they really should be putting their time into. At NYU, one of the world's leading international legal scholars gave a talk at one stage, and it was all about why human rights is not serious, why there is no such thing as a meta-norm and therefore there couldn't be rights, that there could be no way of proving or justifying any particular rights, that these are all totally contingent on subjectivity, etc., etc. And when a student stood up and said, "Professor, this is quite distressing to me because I wanted to make a career in the field of human rights," the response of the professor was, "Look, I'm really sorry. All I can do is lead you to the abyss and tell you that it's there. There isn't, as far as I know, a way of jumping over it. You've got to work out from there where to go." I don't underestimate the extent to which the best of critical scholarship in this field has taught us a lot. But I also don't underestimate how much critical scholarship is drivel, is not focused, in any useful or meaningful way on the real challenges that confront us and on the challenges that are becoming more and more real by the day in our world. I'm not saying that we should all become activists, but I do think that all scholars should take responsibility for what, ironically, many of the critical scholars are always talking about, which is unintended consequences. They go on endlessly about human rights proponents not taking account of the unintended consequences of what they advocate. Well, it would be great if the critical scholars would take account of the, quote, unintended consequences of a lot of the work that they do. This is not for a moment an attempt to diminish critical scholarship. A lot of the ideas that I've mentioned tonight, I think, draw upon some of the best of that scholarship. But there's an awful lot of dead-end stuff which simply leads us to despair. I want to finish with something that will probably strike you as rather corny, but I think it's appropriate. It's simply the old admonition by Pastor Martin Niemöller, made during the period between the two wars. And today's version would be simply, I'm living in New York, first they came for the Hispanics, and I didn't speak out because I wasn't a Hispanic. Then they came for the Muslims, and I didn't speak out because I wasn't a Muslim. Then they came for the Black Lives Matters activists, and I didn't speak out because I'm not black. Then they degraded and belittled women, and I didn't speak out because I'm not a woman. Then they came for me, and there was no one left to speak for me. And so I think the point is simply that we can't wait. We need to start acting. We need to do whatever we can do to strengthen international human rights, the commitment to it in our own lives, in our own areas. We are going to need to operate in a much more creative fashion, internationally, locally. There's going to be a movement between the two, but there are always places where we can make a difference. And I think that the general thrust then of what I've argued is that these are extraordinarily dangerous times, unprecedentedly so, at least in my lifetime. There was a degree of certainty during the Cold War. Today we have lost all of that, and almost anything seems possible. So the response is really up to us. I'll leave it at that.
Thank you, Philip. Thank you very much indeed for a very inspiring and enlightening lecture. And there's a lot to think about there for academics and human rights activists. Now, we have some time for questions, and I know many people will have questions. A lot of issues that have been raised there. So I'll take questions in groups of three. And also you'll see our wonderful stewards in the red shirts coming round, roving with their microphones to those who I indicate who've raised their hands. So please wait until they're with you, and hold a mic right in front of your face so that everyone can hear your question. And I know this can cause a short delay, but please be patient. And also, when you ask your question, can I ask you to give your name and your institutional affiliation? And please, I know all of us have a lot to say or rant about Donald Trump, but please can I ask that you don't make speeches and stick to short questions. I want to try and get as many questions as I can in the time that we have. And a good rule of thumb is that your question should be much shorter in the length of time it takes to say it than the answer that you expect. Yeah. Okay, so who'd like to? Okay, just that person, just behind you.
Thank you. Thank you for this. Very interesting. However, I wonder whether we need to problematize the term populist, because you can construe the term populist in different ways. And I wonder if this, what sense you give to the term populist, and if you mean right-wing populism, fair enough. But there's also another type of populist, and by that I mean Laclau and Mouffe's notion of populism, which actually ties up with what you said as one, you mentioned as one of your strategies. Do not just focus on human rights, but also on human rights, economic and social rights, you said. And you also said that fundamentally they are misunderstood by governments and activists. And I want to stress what you said by governments. Is it a fundamental misunderstanding?
Okay, I want to get some more questions in, but I think your question is...
different political,
Your question is very clear. It's about the meanings of populism, which has been hugely debated. Everybody is talking about populism. Every day there's an event at the LSE talking about left and right-wing populism. That's a very good question. Can we have a question just here? Thank you.
Thank you for your talk. You mentioned briefly about resources being the next battle for humans around the world. And I wanted to hear your opinion on whether the climate change conversation could also be redefined as a human rights issue, especially regarding populations in small island nations. Thank you.
Thank you.
Hi. You said that you think that we need to start looking at fiscal policy. I wonder what you meant by that and how you think that we can achieve that goal.
Okay. And can I just take one more question from this question at the front?
Hi, my name is Brenda Evrujewa. I'm a human rights activist from Poland. I'm studying law at the University of Wrocław. And my question was specifically, how do we actually tackle the legal attacks on civil society? For example, as you may or may not know, in Poland, the government is very effectively pushing through a bill which will make certain demonstrations illegal, giving the government a right to have priority over who should demonstrate on a certain day. If, for example, I was the organizer of a pride march in my hometown, if the government decided on that day they wanted to have a counter demonstration, it would be illegal for me to then demonstrate. So how do we fight the legal challenges to a civil society and also problems with funding, which is threatened to be cut? Thank you.
Thank you very much. That's four excellent questions. Would you like to we'll take some more questions?
No. Is this working?
Yeah.
Yeah. I agree that there are a great many definitions of populism. And I think it's probably not very productive. I've actually got a few down here in my notes because I had thought maybe I'd talk about that. Then I sort of followed your line, which is that there's been so much written about it that I'm not going to add anything to it. I think we can assume that there's a nominally a belief in the wisdom of the common person. But there's the great irony, of course, of Trump appointing every billionaire in sight to look after the interests of the common person who have been screwed by NAFTA and various other things. So obviously a populist government is not necessarily going to be looking after the interests of the people, as it claims to be. Climate change as a human rights issue, I would earn the lifetime wrath of Mary Robinson if I were to be in the least bit sceptical about that claim. One of the things that I am starting to think, and this is heresy for me because I've been a narrow-minded human rights person for most of my career, is that we are actually going to have to take human rights to other
agenda areas in order to pursue them. So a good example of that, I keep being asked in my capacity as Special Rapporteur on Extreme Poverty, what do I think of the sustainable development goals that the UN spent years and vast amounts of time and money adopting? And the honest answer, which I don't give very often, is not a lot. But I'm now being forced to sort of rethink that, because it may well be that the relatively anodyne commitments that governments have made in that context will provide a more effective forum for pushing some of the social justice type issues that we value in the absence of human rights opportunities, of opportunities to push mainstream human rights in those countries. I'm happy to emphasize that climate change, which is unaddressed by those who are responsible, by those who could be addressing it. I won't, of course, say anything here about the Australian government. Well, there's nothing to be said other than that they're contributing to climate change as much as they can. So I think that that does contribute very much to violating the rights of a lot of people. Human rights and fiscal policy, the area that is most interesting for me, will strike many of you as rather specialised. There is a move at the international level to promote what's called a social protection floor, to have every government, every country, commit to providing this social protection floor. And the best definition of it, I won't go into details, is provided by the International Labour Organization in some exotic instrument called Recommendation 202. But the work that they've been doing seeks very explicitly to address the fiscal concern, because people will automatically say, what? Social protection floor? But I'm from... And then you can put in, you know, Botswana, Bangladesh, whatever country, and that's completely beyond our resource capacities. And what this, what the ILO and its many supporters have been doing is to explore precisely how fiscal space could be created in every single country if people wanted to do it. I remember going to Guatemala fairly dramatically a few years ago and discovering that the government would say to me, oh, we can't afford this, we can't afford that. And what I discovered was that they were telling the truth. They couldn't afford it, because they made sure that the total fiscal take, the tax take, was about 10% of GDP, which meant they had no money. But they made sure they had no money. The elites in the Congress wouldn't raise taxes, wouldn't ensure that any of them paid taxes. And so, yeah, they didn't have money. But like me, the old white man, they didn't have to worry. They had their own security forces. They had their own schools. They had their own everything. They didn't need the government to have money. And so what we're going to see, I think, in the years ahead is a much greater concerted attack on the role of the state in terms of protecting basic social values, the accelerated privatisation under the new regimes, because that's the easiest way to slip money to your colleagues, is to privatise. And it sets them up for decades in advance and ensures that public services are going to be greatly reduced for decades in advance. Finally, legal tax on civil society. I don't know what to say, I have to admit. One reads, I think, excellent work coming out of the Venice Commission on Poland. One reads about the pusillanimity of the European Commission that doesn't want to push in relation to Article 7 and Hungary or eventually Poland. One reads about the cat and mouse game that President Kaczynski and President Orbán are playing, where they're convinced that there will be no consequences. I guess we have to conclude that that is deeply problematic, and we can't simply abandon an attachment to the rule of law, which is being systematically undermined in quite a few countries by precisely the sort of moves that you describe.
Okay. Thanks, Philip. And there's a person just waiting there. Actually, while we're waiting, can I just... one of the things that struck me around social rights was that... am I right in thinking that essentially you're asking human rights or the human rights agenda to turn towards advocating a form of social democracy, that that's actually a value today? And is that something that we should be thinking about, you know, in the broader sense, in opposition to neoliberalism? Is social democracy with social and economic rights the best we can offer? So that's, I'll add that into the mix.
Michael Olatokun from the Bingham Centre for the Rule of Law, and my question is in two parts, if that's allowed, Chair. The first part is about the public. How can we as human rights activists ensure that the public are sufficiently educated about human rights and constitutional issues to hold their governments to account? And then the other part is the converse of that question. How can we ensure that rule of law considerations are central to the way that governments treat constitutional issues across the world?
Thank you. And
When you talk about the test of democracy, could it be that perhaps you're confusing symptom and syndrome?
Could you just repeat that, please?
When you talk about the test of democracy, could it be that you somehow seem to confuse symptom and syndrome, that what you list are a number of symptoms to perhaps a democracy itself that may be ill? For instance, the UK, with the lack of proportional representation in the House of Lords, that maybe democracy itself is ill at its core and needs to be resolved.
Okay, challenging question, and one just there, one more.
I'm a MSc human rights student here. Could you talk a little bit about you know, this area of social rights and the need for solidarity in order to achieve them? I wonder if there's a paradox at the heart of the human rights agenda, which is in promoting individual rights, do we lose this idea of collectivism, which perhaps is the major power that we're lacking, human collectivism and solidarity in the promotion of social rights in particular?
Okay, thank you. Again, excellent series of questions. Philip?
Well, let me start at the end. Michael Ignatieff, in his work on the politics of human rights, reached the conclusion, he didn't trash solidarity, but he argued that the only thing that really motivates decent behaviour is fear, and that if we fear that something is going to happen to us or our loved ones, then we will value it and we will act. And I think his argument was that solidarity isn't actually going to get us very far. And I'm sure he would look at the anti-immigrant movements in a great many countries and say that this is a manifestation of that, that we don't give a damn about these outsiders. We don't want to treat them as being human in any meaningful sense, given their situation. And so I suppose the question is whether the agenda that I'm talking about is best presented as a form of social solidarity, or trying to respond to the fears of those who really fear that they're being left behind by the emerging economic order. I guess the answer is one has to try both tracks, but I'm not sure that I would then just endorse a solidarity approach as the only one, or necessarily even the best one. I'm not sure what to say about democracy being rotten at the core. One of the things that is striking about living in the United States, I was living in the U.S. At the time of the Cold War, at the time of the fall of the Berlin Wall, And I was contacted at one stage by representatives of the American Bar Association. Oh, Professor Alston, we would love you to be going and doing rule of law training in some of these countries of Eastern and Central Europe. Oh, really? Why me? I mean, I'm not American, and I don't really work on a lot of the issues that you think are important. What is there that I could add? Would it be social rights, because I've done a lot of work in that? No. That's not what we mean, Professor. No. That's communism. We've moved past that. The important thing is that these people have to understand that a model of democracy essentially would have a very powerful Supreme Court, ideally, say, two houses of what we might call Congress, and an executive president. And, of course, that model was promoted and deeply believed in by Americans for many years, and yet the longer one lives in the United States, the more one becomes utterly disillusioned with a completely dysfunctional form of democracy in so many ways. And you talk about the rigging of the House of Lords or whatever, if that's what it is. I know too little about the House of Lords composition. But the rigging of electoral boundaries in the United States is legendary. It's what it's all about. But the Supreme Court doesn't want to touch that, doesn't consider it to be a problem. I don't know what we can do. I think one needs to just continue to draw attention to it. I think trying to get back to human rights principles and so on. Human rights principles, of course, would never be admitted, acknowledged in the US, because we Americans don't need international human rights. We have a perfect system of our own. Let's start trying to rethink that. Let's see if there might actually be some relevance in the United States of those basic principles. And the first question about, I'm not sure, the education of human rights activists and the how we make rule of law considerations central to what governments do.
It's more about the education of the public. What could human rights activists do?
Right. This won't be a very good answer to your question. I have often found human rights education to be ridiculous, and I've had to sit through quite a lot of it. You go to some village, which will conjure up somewhere, probably not in Surrey or wherever, and someone gets up and says, I'm going to tell you about the Convention on the Elimination of All Forms of Discrimination Against Women. Article 1 of that convention. And it's as though that is going to be in any way meaningful. I think what Sally Merry, a colleague of mine at NYU, has written a lot about this, about the need for vernacularization, the need to translate. I don't think simply taking a human rights document and saying, well, here, you idiot, this is it, read, and you'll understand. It's discussion. It's relating it to their experience. That's what human rights education should really be all about. But I think there's all too little of that done.
Okay, thank you, Philip. I think we've run out of time for questions, but you can talk to Philip outside. Before we leave, can I just remind you about some other important centre events? The theme of populism is going to be central to all of them in different ways, I would guess, for the foreseeable future.
Right,
next term, Kenneth Roth, Director of Human Rights Watch, will be coming to speak. Nick Lowles of Hope Not Hate will be running a workshop. Professor Susan Buck-Moores, Professor of Political Science at CUNY Graduate Center, and Radhika Balakrishnan, Professor of Gender Studies and Women's Rights, will be at Rutgers, will all be coming. And if you'd like to know more about the center events, please sign up online or follow us on Twitter at LSE Human Rights. Can I thank Philip for coming to speak to us this evening?